Very sugary.
Welcome, everybody, to the April 7, 2011 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. All righty, we've got a full agenda, mostly things that we're not going to move are here. It's that time of the session. Specifically, for those who are in the room, we are not going to do anything with 438, 506, Senate Bill 506 or Senate Bill 442 today. We're still waiting for some amendments. Seems to be perpetual. We're going to have a hearing on Senate Bills 795 and 672, Senate Bill 775 and 133, and we're going to do a work session on Senate Bill 156, 485, and 958 as soon as Senator Starr comes back. All righty. Well, while we're waiting, here, Senator Starr. I will open a work session on Senate Bill 156. Richard.
Senate Bill 156 delineates affirmative duties owed by a real estate property manager to a property owner. It modifies provisions relating to client trust accounts to include licensed real estate property managers. It modifies provisions relating to record keeping, continuing education, and license issuance and renewal for certain real estate licenses. We have a dash one amendment, which allows applicants for licenses issued by the real estate agency to pay fees directly to third-party vendors that provide services required as part of the application process. And we have a dash two amendment that removes references to fiduciary in affirmative duties owed to a real estate property manager and requires records on continuing education to be required for only at least a three-year period as opposed to indefinitely. There's no revenue impact. And let's see, there's no fiscal impact on either of those as well.
Thank you. Members, you'll recall we heard this last week. There are a couple of issues that Senator Bonamici was going to work on. Senator?
No. Nope.
No?
That's a different bill.
Oh, am I on the wrong one?
Yeah.
45.
Oh, I'm in real estate. I'm sorry, Senator. They're running together. The chair moves the dash ones to Senate Bill 156. Is there discussion? Is there any opposition? There is none. Dash ones are adopted. Chair moves the dash twos to Senate Bill 156. Discussion? Is there any opposition? There is none. Dash twos are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 156 as adopted by the dash one and dash twos to the floor with the due pass. Discussion? Is there any opposition? Senate Bill 156 is amended, is passed unanimously to the floor with a due pass. Let's see. Who would like to? Would you like to carry this, Senator Edwards? Senator Edwards will carry. Open work session on Senate Bill 485. Richard.
Senate Bill 485 allows the real estate agency to issue a cease and desist order and maintain action for injunction against a person who engages or is about to engage in professional real estate activity without a license. There is a dash one amendment, which I'll let the senator explain. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Senator. Thank you, Chair Beyer and committee members. Thank you for setting this bill for a work session. You may recall that during the public hearing on this bill, we had testimony and support from the real estate agency, from the Department of Justice. And we had also at the time of the hearing someone from a lawyer representing the Northwest Real Estate Investors Association concerned because it was their understanding that the real estate agency could obtain a cease and desist order against someone operating without a license without a hearing, and there were some due process issues raised at that time. As the chair recognized, the real estate agency does have to go through the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act. In the testimony that the Northwest Real Estate Investors Association submitted, I'll read from this letter. They said that they do not oppose the agency's right to seek a cease and desist order or injunction after a hearing on the merits that affords the proper due process procedural rights to the accused. So, Mr. Chair, in committee, we did have an amendment drafted that added the, it's a very simple amendment. It adds subject to ORS Chapter 183, which, Mr. Chair, in committee, is the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act, to clarify that the agency may only issue an order, a cease and desist order, after going through the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act hearings process. We also discovered that there's one statute that gives in this bill authority to get a cease and desist order in the area of escrow agents, but that's already done in another statute, so this amendment deletes that as well. So this clarifies and I believe resolves the concerns of the people who were here at the public hearing who testified in opposition, and I encourage you, Mr. Chair and committee, to pass this bill with a due pass recommendation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senators. Any questions, Senator Bonamici? There's none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The chair moves the dash ones to Senate Bill 485. Discussion. No discussion. Is there any opposition? No opposition. Senate Bill 485 is adopted unanimously. All right. Senator Burdick, you were here and you were in agreement to that, right?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
I thought you were.
100%.
Record Senator Burdick, make sure that she's recorded as well. Senate Bill, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 958. Richard.
Senate Bill 958 expands application requirements for dismantler certificates to include the applicant's National Motor Vehicle Title Information System identification number. It defines motor vehicle crusher and crushed motor vehicle. It establishes requirements for use of mobile vehicle crushers by dismantlers. We heard it on 331. There's no revenue and minimal fiscal impact. I believe Tom Gallagher and I forget who else was involved in this.
Mr. Fuller, Mr. Gallagher, did you and your client get your concerns worked out?
Yes, I
did. You did? See the head shake there?
Bill's good to go.
Any questions? Anybody? Chair moves Senate Bill 958 to the floor with a due pass. Discussion.
They're all just locked in.
You're just moving, Mr. Fuller, we're just moving your floor. Your bill to the floor. Do you want to discuss it?
If you have questions.
You could always work on a no, but you probably don't want to.
Tom tells me to be quiet. Okay. I do what Tom tells me.
No discussion. Is there any opposition? Senate Bill 958 is moved to the floor with a due pass by unanimous vote. All right.
Carrier.
I actually got something passed.
Carrier.
Okay,
the crusher.
Senator Starr will carry, and I think I didn't do it on the second one either.
I don't assume Bonamici will.
Senator Bonamici will. Yes, let's ask her to carry her bill.
Okay.
All right, so now we'll move back to the top of the agenda, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 795 and Senate Bill 672, both of which deal with transportation planning rule. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. I won't read through, but there is an amendment that I've received, the dash six amendments to 795, and we also got a letter from 1,000 Friends of Oregon for the record that's in your packet. I have not yet received, I don't have any amendments on 672, but I received a letter from 1,000 Friends and a letter from Mark Patel with the City of Salem on 672.
Senator Telford, did you wish to speak on this at all?
No, I'm just here for the entertainment.
We'll do our best. Okay, let's see here. Mr. Russell and Mr. Whitlow.
So, Mr. Chair, there's a dash 7 amendment. Richard, you didn't get the dash 7?
I have not received the dash 7.
I sent them to you at 12:03.
I apologize. I've been busy today.
The probably should have invited Rob up too, shouldn't I, from DLCD?
Absolutely.
And probably Jerry from ODOT too. Since y'all have been intimately involved in crafting this thing, I should say the compromise.
Yeah, I think you're going to.
Yeah, you can. Sure. Okay. Whoever wants to start. Go ahead, Rob.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Rob Halliburton, representing the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 795, the -6 amendments. And I don't believe the TPR, the Transportation Planning Rule, probably needs a lot of introduction, but I thought I'd give a little bit. The TPR is an administrative rule adopted by our commission, LCDC, to connect land use and transportation planning. The two major parts of what the TPR requires is a system-wide look by cities and counties at the whole transportation system, and also level of analysis at the time land use changes are proposed at the impacts of that use, the proposed use on the transportation system. And it's that latter issue that Senate Bill 795 addresses. I also wanted to mention the TPR utilizes the Oregon Highway Plan when a comprehensive plan amendment or zone change affects a state highway, so the amendments do affect ODOT as well. And the -6 amendments have two primary substantive provisions. The first is in Section 4 of the bill and of the -6 amendments. And this section requires LCDC and OTC to consider revisions to the rules, plans, and guidance documents as necessary to simplify and clarify planning requirements. And the rules there, of course, is the Transportation Planning Rule. The primary plan that we're talking about is the Oregon Highway Plan. And but there's the general guidance to simplify and clarify those rules and plans and guidance documents, but there's also a specific direction to address issues including practical mitigation of impacts of economic development projects, options to simplify increased development in urban centers, highway mobility standards, and the analysis required for UGB amendments. We're confident that the list that's included in the bill covers the major issues with the transportation planning rule. LCDC has had several hours of testimony, gathering information on the issues, gotten lots of written testimony. Both the LCDC and the Oregon Transportation Commission appointed subcommittees who have jointly met on several occasions, and they also received lots of testimony on the issues with the TPR and the Oregon Highway Plan. And we did a survey of Oregon planners, private and public planners, to get even more input on the list. And we've run that through the joint subcommittees and gotten a recommendation from the joint subcommittees on the issues that were the most pertinent to work on right away. And those issues found their way into the -6 amendments of this bill. The handout that I provided is a draft recommendation from the joint subcommittee. They met on this on March 30th. What I handed out is the staff report or the draft recommendations that we were providing to the joint subcommittees. They did adopt a recommendation to very close to what you see in front of you. The final amendments that the joint subcommittee requested haven't been prepared yet. What I've given you is the latest draft, and it's very, very close to what they have recommended to LCDC and the Oregon Transportation Commission. And we expect this work to kick off right away. It's on the LCDC's agenda to initiate the TPR rulemaking at their April 21st meeting, and we expect them to, in fact, initiate the rule updates, and we will work on them through the year and finish them by the end of this calendar year. And we believe, well, Jerry's here, but we believe ODOT is going to start working on their parts of what's required in the bill as well right away. We are committed to getting the TPR amendments done by the end of the year. Section 5 of the -6 amendments does, in fact, require that we get it done by then. And we believe that the issues are very complicated with the TPR and that lots of interests are involved and that the rulemaking process is the appropriate way to go about this. Just a little bit on the wording, on some language. The work group that developed the Dash 6 amendments is in general agreement that removing language found on page 3, line 9, the words placed on economic development opportunities should be deleted, that it narrowed the scope of the required revisions too much. Not that we wouldn't consider economic development opportunities, but it wouldn't be limited to that.
Say that again.
Page 3, line 9,
mm-hmm.
The words placed, we recommend deleting the words placed on economic development opportunities. So the second substantive provision of the bill, I'm going a little bit backwards here, are in Section 1. And Section 1 provides immediate relief for mitigation of traffic impacts for some economic development projects. Certain comprehensive plan amendments and zone changes that may result in significant transportation impacts will have a reduced burden for making system improvements to offset their impact as a result of Section 1 of the Dash 6 amendments. I don't want to say it solves all ills or even very many. It is a very narrow amendment. I want to say that we recognize that right up front. But we believe that the larger issues will be addressed during the rulemaking process that we're embarking on for the rest of the year, and that DLCD supports the Dash 6 amendments.
Jerry?
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, committee members. So for the record, I'm Jerry Bohart. I'm the Interim Deputy Director for Operations for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I really don't have much to add to what Rob has said other than our commission's and our agency's commitment to do the work that's outlined in the section relative to the Oregon Highway Plan. We've already actually started much of that work. We have a research project underway looking at other possibilities for mobility standards and also making some corrections to our guidance documents. So we're well on the way for completing this work. I'm glad to answer any questions you might have specifically.
Any questions of either Jerry or...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief clarification. Are we talking about the underlying bill, or are you talking about amendments, or... I'm trying to get caught up with you here.
Chair Beyer, Senator Everett. Referring to the Dash 6 amendments, particularly, I think it's section...
Okay, Dash 6 is not Dash 7s that are also have just been distributed to the committee.
Okay. I have not seen the Dash 7s.
Okay. Thank you.
I think the items she listed, Senator, are also duplicated in the Dash 7s, but they're on page 2, starting on page 2.
Okay. Thank you.
Line 21. Let me just be really clear. There, many of the members have had concerns raised about the TPR and its effect in the communities. There's certainly been a couple of court cases that have really, frankly, messed things up in the way it works. There are legitimate planning and safety issues and mobility standards out there. I think we all recognize that. We did have a legislative subgroup working on this, and we recognize that it is somewhat complex. I believe both commissions, and I've spoken with both directors as well as the governor's natural resource advisor about this, and there is a commitment that they have made to hearing the concerns that we've had, that they're going to take care of this, address these, and come back to us by the end of, actually by December. And my comment to them has been, we're going to be oversighting this and watching very closely, and if you don't, we will take it up again in January, and we will do the work, which may not be the best thing to do, but hopefully it'll all work out. So that's just kind of, if you will, putting you on notice.
So,
thank you both. Now, Mr. Russell, Mr.
Yep,
Whitlock.
My apologies.
Mr. Whitlock.
I think with the DAS 7s yours?
Yes.
Okay. And this is the first time I've seen these, so I'm not sure how they differ either. Obviously, we don't have reviews or fiscal or that, so we won't be able to move anything today.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mark Whitlow. I'm here on behalf of the Retail Task Force and International Council of Shopping Centers, two industry groups that have been involved in the TPR over the years. In fact, we've worked on three of the prior amendments, the first of which was in 1995, the last of which was in 2005 in response to the JAQUA decision. I've submitted a letter to you, and I would just begin by saying we're trying to reduce to simplicity things that are often viewed as confusing in the rule. So the dash 6, we think, actually makes things worse for those of us who are trying to move forward sooner than later with rule amendments or statute that would override the rule in a way that would enhance economic growth and development this year, not next year. Two things that are at play here in the Dash 7 version would be to, again, simplify the existing rule to allow zone changes that are in conformance with comprehensive plans without them treating as those events as triggering the rule. And we talked about that with the department in 2005, the local jurisdictions, both cities and counties, perhaps a majority part, are in favor of that because acknowledged comprehensive plans anticipate the zone changes to implement them. And so if it weren't for the awkward wording of the rule, a zone change that implements a comprehensive plan wouldn't trigger the review of the rule. So your Dash 7 version says that it would not, because zone changes in conformance with comprehensive plans would not be deemed to significantly affect the transportation system. So that's an easy piece of low-hanging fruit, as we were looking for things to streamline and simplify, again, this year, not next year, and aid projects that want to go forward. And those projects would be both public projects and private sector projects. But in the public arena, work needs to be done to adopt mixed-use zoning districts that generally aren't available. And so if you want to come forward and build out the policies of our communities and our state to intensify use and development through mixed-use development, that has been a problem. And so it's a rule trigger. Also, if you want to do compact urban form development through infill and refill, those often require plan amendments inside growth boundaries. So let me shift my focus for a second to the Dash 6. Dash 6 changes the existing rule. So you have in my letter, the first attachment, a copy of existing Rule Section 63. If you compare, it is not limited to industrial development or amendments for industrial development. And it also applies to facilities that are already performing below the minimum acceptable performance standard. We have a plethora of projects that are relying on that existing rule that the Dash 6 amendments would overshadow. Dash 6 applies only to industrial developments and only to circumstances where the facility is operating within the minimum acceptable performance standards. So it changes it in two ways. And it's very simple. Paper covers rock. The statute trumps the rule. If you pass Dash 6, I personally have clients who have projects that will suddenly not be able to go forward with those projects, even though they've been working on them for 2 years or more, and that are, you know, new stores being built, one of which is in Portland, $20 million project that would simply be stopped by the passage of that bill. Why it was written in a way that is less than what is already in the administrative rule, I can't tell you. But because it is
Mr. Russell?
More narrow, because it is more narrow than the rule already provides, the statute is going to diminish the rule. So that's the one point. The Dash 7 bill simply, again, simplifies things. Mr. Halbert talked about the system analysis and the site-specific analysis. The system analysis in many particulars isn't necessary. For example, you're required to do a long-range study, spend, you know, about a year and anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 in cost to study the system to find that it's deficient, only then to engage in measures to avoid it. And so court cases have recently recognized that there's no reason to go around the barn and do that. If you can avoid through a measure or improvements or a state determination that a certain set of circumstances don't constitute a significant effect, you've just simplified things enormously. So what Dash 7 does, it says when you're in four circumstances, a system that's already broken or will become broken by the end of the planning period through no fault of the amendment, and the amendment can cover its own impacts of development, and it's not in an interchange area of the highway, then it's allowed. So the Dash 7 version says, under those circumstances, there would be no significant effect as a matter of state law. Therefore, you don't need to do your one-year $50,000 to $100,000 study and study the system that you're going to simply find is not affected because you're not going to make the system any worse. You will mitigate the impacts of your project. So again, it gets rid of the clutter and the confusion by simply saying, pay your own way as a project, public project, private project, and that is not a significant effect to the transportation system under the rule, and therefore you can get approved sooner than later. It also then provides that plan amendments or, zone changes in conformance with comprehensive plans would not likewise constitute a significant effect under the rule and therefore allow them without doing all the studies.
Ms. Whitwell, I apologize since I was part of that. When we, the proposal that we had from the departments was to keep things the way they were in place now while they changed everything, and we sort of pushed, I was teasing Mr. Russell because it was he and I that pushed and said, we need to have something for industrial to, and Bob, I think we might have screwed it up.
Industrial's already covered. So is everything else. So this would diminish what's there and reduce it only to industrial in a context where the system, you know, wouldn't be in a failed condition. So now you can go forward in a failed condition as long as you cover your own impacts for any kind of development, whether it's industrial or not. And that's an important thing. That is one of the few pieces of relief that we garnered from the 2005 amendments, and we would hate to lose those.
Is that consistent with the rule as it exists today?
That is the rule as it exists today.
So and I've essentially what we're saying is we don't want to change the rules. So I would want to make sure, and, you know, in fairness to these two people, they haven't had a chance to see that yet. So if that's consistent with what we're saying, that makes perfect sense to me. I hope the committee would agree with that. Senator Starr, you had a question or a comment?
No, just to clarify, I mean, you provided us a copy of the OAR.
Yes.
Which is the rule, right?
That's correct. Just that section of the rules.
Right. And then Section 1 of the Dash 7 amendments, if I compare the two, there's great similarity. So what you've done primarily here is move what's been in the administrative rule into statute. The part of the rule that works, we're putting into the statute.
That's correct. The only difference would be the avoidance of the long-range transportation study to find a significant effect, because this version starts off with the following circumstances do not constitute a significant effect. So it is a time saver, a money saver, and it's a streamlining measure.
And because, Mr. Chair, if I follow, because it doesn't, it's done in accordance with the comp plan
that's
already been approved by the local government.
Right. And the rest of the language is virtually the same. System's broken now or will become through no fault of the amendment, which will cover its own impacts, but not in areas that are in interchange areas of the state highways.
Mr. Russell?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. And first, let me say that I am not a lawyer, so I cannot render a legal opinion. And second, let me say that perhaps I got out over my skis a little bit on this one and wanted to explain to you sort of why we're here and then what my real interest in all of this is. We have been discussing what is basically Section 1 to the dash 7s for some time. It's not a new discussion this session. There was a work group formed, and Senator Beyer and I attended one meeting, and I was unable to attend the second one that resulted in the dash 6s, Sections 1 and 2. In all other respect, both amendments are the same, so the provisions that direct the agencies on the rulemaking authority and all that stuff are identical. So it's just the beginnings of each of them. When I was understood, or led to believe at least, that the dash sixes, because they would trump the existing rule, actually made the situation worse, that concerned me a great deal, because I didn't believe that we wanted to go down that road. So then we had the dash sevens drafted, which do contain the provisions that we had discussed. I do not believe that there is universal support for the dash sevens, but it certainly does make it better than it is today while we're waiting for the agencies to take action. My principal interest in the transportation planning rule is mobility. The transportation planning rule is designed to keep our highways flowing, which is very, very important to my industry. I believe that the dash sevens, because any applicant or any developer has to mitigate for their direct impacts on the highway, it does not make the situation any worse. And we can live with that while we are providing greater opportunities for development to help the economy get going again. So we view that positively. And that's my principal reason for being here to testify, that we are perfectly fine with the impacts on mobility in the dash sevens.
Questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Linda Ludwig and John Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on Senate Bill 795. Having just seen the dash sevens, I think I like them. I have also just seen the dash sixes. I do not like them. So of the two in front of us, we would support the dash sevens. Our concerns are, as Mr. Whitlow identified, the dash six amendments make the rule worse for residential development by basically excluding anything that isn't industrial development from the current provisions under the TPR, which, as Mr. Whitlow indicated, were a modest victory we got a few years ago during another round of TPR rewriting. We are not fond of the TPR to begin with. If we're going to have the full thing, we ought to make it workable for projects across the board. The dash sevens are a good step in that direction. We would commend them to you of the two in front. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I'd actually signed up to testify in 672. I can comment, if you would like, on 795. I was hoping to defer that today.
It'll be back.
In terms of 672, real quickly, you did receive some electronic, my letters and the letter from Lake Oswego electronically. I hope that the committee has that already in the record. Very, very quickly, we have some strong concerns about Section 2, Sub 3 in 672, which we believe would strictly limit city's authority to improve the public right-of-way. The bill is very broadly written, so it was very difficult to hone down on exactly what the bill was trying to get to. But in terms of the specifics that we think it would apply to, the City of Lake Oswego's memo talks about a provision of their code, the special street setback. And that code section targets streets where the right-of-way is inadequate, does not meet minimum requirements for vehicle head or bicycle safety. And the provision requires a slightly greater building setback in the areas when public street and sidewalk improvements are installed, so that later, when they are installed, the city does not have to pay for building structures in addition to the land cost of the right-of-way. Those are the types of provisions that we believe that the Section 2 sub 3 would actually restrict our authority for. We also believe this bill, that section, would be extremely costly to cities. We believe that cities would have to set aside a large amount of reserve funds to conduct any type of transportation planning or implement advanced preps preparation for street projects under the bill. Would also require all cities to revise their planning codes, their TSPs, and actually their transportation system development charges methodology if they so have it. So there is some cost for us under the bill. So we would ask the committee not to move forward with at least Section 2, Sub 3 of that bill. In terms of the TPR bill, Senate Bill 795, we have shared concerns with Mr. Chandler's industry and with many other people over the course of the last several years about the restrictive nature of the TPR and the implementation of the TPR. We've had conversations over the course of the last 3.5 years with both agencies about our concerns. And we have had a host of cities, between probably 30 and 40 cities, come to my organization as well as DLCD with their concerns. As a result, the League submitted a petition for request to LCDC in November to open up the TPR rule. And both agencies have moved forward with that and have set forward a very aggressive rulemaking revision schedule with adoption by the end of the year. It is our belief that it is in at least cities' best interest to let the agencies move forward with that aggressive rulemaking, which we believe would occur regardless if any of the amendments to or Senate Bill 795 move forward at all. We don't require the bill or either of these sets of amendments, but we also do believe that there is there's reason to believe that the rulemaking process won't take care of all of cities' concerns. It is very likely. It hardly ever does. but we also acknowledge and share the words that the chair delivered to the agencies that if the rulemaking efforts aren't adequate, there certainly is a legislative resolve beginning the first of the year when the legislature comes back in for the short session. So from our perspective, we would like to continue to work with the agencies, see what we can do through the rulemaking process, and then take a hard look at where we are with the TPR. Having said that, there are pieces of both the dash seven and the dash six amendments that we like and that we don't like. And what I'll leave you with today is I believe, and I have gotten an education about transportation planning in the course of the last year, one that I would prefer not to have had, but I believe that there are about 5 people in this state that really thoroughly understand what's at play here, both in the rule itself and how the rule is implemented through the agencies. There's not an august body of people that do. And to that end, it's hard for me to tell you today which of these amendments to look at and which pieces to take out and which we believe would be beneficial long term. Transportation planning is kind of akin to annexation law. It's very, very, very complex. And again, you pull one lever and something else pushes out on the other side. The piece that we do like in the Dash 7 is the piece that the amendment would allow a zone change in conformance with an acknowledged comprehensive plan. That is something that our largest cities have said, have come back to us continuously, that that would be much of an improvement for them, our larger cities, not necessarily our smaller cities. So that's one piece that we are highly supportive of. Again, I don't believe that we need the rulemaking authority. If we do move forward with that, I think Mr. Halliburton stated there was a deletion that would make us, the league, a lot more comfortable with the rulemaking provision of the bill. So I'm sure I've burned every bridge I could possibly burn with my comments. Thank you.
Just welcome to the club. Questions?
Rhetorically, I was wondering if Linda felt that any of the five experts sat at the dais. You don't have to answer that.
I'm doubting it.
Of course, Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, all of the folks sitting at the dais are this dais?
Now we're building bridges.
Thank you.
I like that, building bridges.
Because that's a different bill. We like it too, though, by the way.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on either of these two bills? Seeing none, I do have a question, Jerry, if I may. Senator Telfer's presence reminded me of a discussion we'd had. There was some concern, or not concern, concepts from Central Oregon about corridor planning and mitigation along that route. And my understanding is you can do that by rule, but I just kind of would like you to comment on that. Is that something that's still around? Would that be considered? Am I being too vague?
Senator Beyer, my understanding with regards to the corridor planning, the agency has done corridor planning in the past. In fact, we have a couple of adopted corridor plans, primarily in the Portland area, and we've actually done corridor strategies and studies and a variety of different things along our corridors. And there is an ability, even within the Oregon Highway Plan, to look at one of the things that they wanted to look at was corridor, what we call corridor mobility standards, and that ability exists within the policy of our Oregon Highway Plan. So the ability to do that exists. I did have an opportunity to talk with our region folks. They're actively looking at a corridor plan along US 97 and working with the jurisdictions to agree on what the scope of the plan should be, given the time and the budget and so on. And so that is being actively worked as we speak.
And that will be something that is considered as you do the rulemaking? Or looked at?
Senator, I'm not exactly sure of what your question is there. I don't know that there's any need to do anything with regards to rulemaking. The policy to do all of this work already exists, and we currently do it today. Any changes that may come out of the mobility standards obviously would be part of the discussion of a corridor plan. If they look at alternative mobility standards within their corridor, that ends up being an amendment to the Oregon Highway Plan. But again, that ability to do such a thing does exist today.
Mr. Chair.
Does that get a short question, Senator?
Can I'm encouraged to hear that, and I'm looking forward to working with you.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Senator Stark?
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. The issue, bluntly, is that the folks in Central Oregon have been really frustrated with the inability to develop based on the transportation planning rule and other things. In a transportation corridor plan that apparently the department's working on for Highway 97 in Central Oregon, would that provide the opportunity for development to occur in one section of Highway 97 and the impacts of that development be mitigated in another section of Highway 97? Yes or no?
Senator Beyer, Senator Stark, yes, that would be that would what the corridor plan would, it would look at what improvements are needed along the corridor, the type of development that might be occurring there and what they want to have in the future. It would also look at potentially other modes and how it might help mitigate or what the local system might be doing to help mitigate, so all of that. But that is one of the key things about a corridor plan is the idea is to look along the corridor and say, what is it that we want to occur in the future, and what's the best way to make sure that the visions of all of the communities along that corridor are met. So, yes, I do believe it does take agreement with all of the communities that are along the corridor, and sometimes that is a struggle. But that's why we work really hard to agree on the scope right from the get-go.
Additional follow-up. I understand that work is underway today. How soon or when will that work be completed?
Senator Starr, typically a corridor plan, depending on what they've done with their scope, is about an 18-month project. It depends on what they've put in their scope of their work. As I understand it right now, in just an email conversation I've had with the region manager, they're agreeing to the scope of work right now. Usually takes a little bit to get the consultant on board. And then it really depends on the energy of the local community and how hard they want to work it, how often they want to meet, and that sort of thing. But typically it does take about 18 months or so to put that together.
So I didn't hear an end date. So are they starting now, so it's 18 months from now?
Senator Beyer, Senator Starr, yes, they're in conversations today. I don't believe they've agreed on the scope of work from the emails trail that I've seen. So I would say that the 18 months really probably starts once they agree on the scope of work.
Who's they?
It's my understanding, Senator may actually have more information than I do on this one because I haven't been involved in it, is that they've been meeting with representatives from each of the jurisdictions, Ben, Redmond, Madras, and working through what they want to accomplish in the corridor plan. I do know that those conversations have been going on.
Mr. Chair, just additional
I could
follow
get
up,
some
follow-up conversation.
Additional information.
I'm just encouraging the department to move quicker than 18 months because I'd hate to have Senator Telfer come back here 2 years from now, introduce legislation because the situation has not been solved in Central Oregon.
Thank you.
I think they hear that, Senator. I think part of it is dependent on how quickly the local, sounds like how quickly the local people work on it, too. So it's that's a bit of a partnership. But I'm confident that Senator Telfer will oversee that and make it work fine. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Any other questions of anybody? Once again, anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bills 795 and 672, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 775. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 775 prohibits a manufacturer, distributor, or importer of motor vehicles from requiring a franchisee to enter into a site control agreement. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this measure.
Mr. Gallagher and Cosgrove.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. I'm going to start just briefly to set the stage for what this bill does, and then we'll be discussing the Dash 1 amendment. ORS 650, 120 through 170 is a series of statutory requirements of what we can have in our contracts when a manufacturer issues a franchise to a motor vehicle dealer to sell new cars. And section 1 of the bill is the definition section in the statute, and on page 3 you'll see we add a new definition of a site control agreement. Section 2 of the bill starts the lists of the things that cannot be in a franchise agreement. You'll see on line 32 of page 3, excuse me, notwithstanding the terms of any franchise or other agreement, a manufacturer, distributor, importer may not. And current law, as you go over for the next couple of pages, has 14 separate sections of things that may not be in a franchise agreement. This bill, with the Dash 1 amendments, adds two more. What the Dash 1 amendments also do, though, is it doesn't make some of the changes that are in the bill as printed. If you look on page 4, there's both bold and italicized language. The amendments remove all of that. And if you look on page 5, there's a little bit of italicized language at the bottom of the page. Excuse me, page 6, sorry. And the amendments remove that as well. What the amendments then do is, in lieu of the language on page 7, the boldface language, if you look at the Dash 1 amendment and on line 13, sub 15, and then on the back sub 16 are added, and they deal with site control agreements and a concept that we call dueling, which is not with swords, with an E-L-I-N-G. It is having two brands at the same location or owned by the same dealer. And what the bill does with the Dash 1 amendments is it further restricts what manufacturers can have in their agreements with dealers on those two subjects, site control agreements and dueling. We have been working diligently for weeks. And what you have in the Dash 1 amendments is an agreed set of standards that for these new provisions in franchise agreements between our manufacturers and dealers. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Seeing Mr. Gallagher, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Automobile Dealers Association. And remembering my last trip up in front of this committee, I'd like to oppose my own bill. I think I would just pick up where Paul left off. This is an agreement that's worked out between the auto dealers and the manufacturers, and I really appreciate that the manufacturers were able to sit down and work through this bill with us. Some of these changes came about because of the difficulty that the auto industry went through in the recession and the closure of GM and so forth, and I'm very happy that it looks like the auto industry and the country is recovering and those things will go away. Two amendments on site control have to do with in some cases, what about the site after the franchise is terminated? Can you contractually agree to, like, keep the corner station, the corner lot, from being used by another automobile franchise? Can the manufacturer control that because it's a good site? So he closes the dealership, but you can't use the lot for another franchise. They were gracious enough to making a decision on that, which allows us to deal with some of the site control issues and not have to be put those in contract. The second one on dueling is what happens when you have a GM and a Toyota on the same site. And the interesting thing about the way this language is written, there are some dealerships that were in place before 1999 that will have no conditions on their ability to put two franchises on the same site. And those dealerships after 1999 will have some language, as we proposed here, that will put some restrictions on how they can operate two franchises at the same site. So there's a great deal of give and take between the manufacturers and the auto dealers here, just like there is in the franchise agreements themselves, and we're happy to be here in agreement.
Questions, gentlemen? Looks like you got off easy.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on 775? Seeing none. Richard, is there any additional information for the record?
Nope.
And we do not have fiscals, so we can't move the bill, so we will close the that's correct, right? Mm-hmm. We will close the work session on the public hearing on Senate Bill 775, and we open a public hearing on Senate Bill 133.
Senate Bill 133 exempts persons applying for restricted motorcycle endorsement from operation of a motorcycle with more than two wheels from meeting requirements for motorcycle endorsement. There's no revenue impact, and I don't yet have a fiscal impact on this.
All righty. So, let's see. Van Moore, Steve Garretts, and Michael John. You're welcome to all come up at once. I only have three people, so. Well, you don't have to if you don't want. You don't want to, that's fine, too. Doesn't imply you agree with them.
You never can tell, he might. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Van Moore. I'm a resident of Salem, and I'm here in my capacity as the Vice Chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee for Motorcycle Safety. As you may know, the Governor's Advisory Committee for Motorcycle Safety was formed in 1985. It's comprised of eight members of the public that represent the voice of Oregon motorcyclists, and advise the governor and the governor's highway safety representative on motorcycle safety issues in Oregon. Senate Bill 133 was very narrowly written to accomplish one thing and one thing only, that being the exemption of individuals applying for a motorcycle endorsement that is restricted to the operation of a three-wheeled motorcycle from the current requirement that they complete a motorcycle rider education course. Currently, pursuant to Senate Bill 546, signed into law in 2009, individuals who wish to obtain a motorcycle endorsement are required to take an approved motorcycle safety training course. The requirements of Senate Bill 546 are being phased in over a five-year period beginning in January of this year, with those 30 years of age and younger, and culminating in 2015 with the requirement for all new applicants for endorsement to complete training. Unfortunately, Oregon's approved motorcycle safety training program, Team Oregon, has neither the equipment nor adequately configured practicum training ranges to accommodate the wide variety of three-wheeled and sidecar configurations that are currently available, some of which you have in pictures before you. These vehicles have handling characteristics that are more akin to four-wheel vehicles than they do of a motorcycle. Additionally, it is important to know that the current DMV demand for these restricted J endorsements is 30 or fewer per year. Senate Bill 133 would change the mandatory training requirements of 2009's SB 546 to exempt those persons seeking an endorsement that is restricted to operating only a three-wheeled or side-equipped motorcycle. Senate Bill 133 in no way impinges upon the Oregon Department of Motor Vehicles' current ability or need to conduct both knowledge and skills testing of these endorsement applicants. Implementation of Senate Bill 133 would save the state precious resources, as without the provisions contained therein, there would be a need to be a training program developed to benefit a small population of riders. And due to the cost of the equipment and training space, such a program has the potential to be extremely costly. The Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety supports the efforts of Senate Bill 133 for two primary reasons. The first is that the handling characteristics of three-wheeled motorcycles may not have the direct correlation to those of a traditional single-track two-wheeled motorcycle, around which motorcycle safety training has been designed. The second is a relatively small number of the restricted endorsements that are issued and the cost that would be incurred to meet these limited needs. The Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety supports Senate Bill 133 because it allows those individuals who choose to limit their motorcycle endorsement to vehicles with three wheels the opportunity to be properly tested and licensed through the DMV without taking additional training. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Steve Garretts. I represent the Team Oregon Motorcycle Safety Program. You have before you my testimony, and I echo Van's testimony as well, to exempt the motorcycle, three-wheel motorcycles from the mandatory motorcycle training requirement. Team Oregon is the state's funded motorcycle safety program. We're funded by motorcycle endorsements and renewals through the Oregon Department of Transportation. We're headquartered at Oregon State University and have been there since 1984, receiving national attention and recognition. And unlike most state programs, we have designed our own proprietary curriculum that is designed around the needs of the riders in this state and the problems that they are having. We offer two motorcycle training courses that are approved by ODOT for mandatory training requirements. One is the Basic Rider Training Program, the BRT, and the IRT. The BRT is designed for new riders who've never ridden a motorcycle, and the IRT is designed for riders who have some riding experience or who rode some time ago and returning to motorcycles. Two-wheel motorcycles and scooters are provided to the students who take the BRT and the IRT. We do not provide three-wheel motorcycles. And as Van said, our range exercises do not accommodate the stance of a three-wheel vehicle.
nor does it handle the accommodate the handling characteristics. As I said, we support Senate Bill 133. The three-wheel motorcycles handle completely differently from two-wheel motorcycles. That third wheel creates stability at lower speeds, but changes the way in which the vehicle steers and responds to operator input. And as a result, we can't integrate those vehicles into our existing rider training programs. Completely new curricula would have to be designed, tested, and implemented. We would have to train instructors in how to treat three-wheel motorcycles and their special handling characteristics, and then we would have to provide it on a statewide basis to meet Oregon law. The cost and logistics of deploying a three-wheel program that would meet such small numbers would really be cost prohibitive. And you can see below in my written testimony some of the figures that we have, but I want to point out that during the years 2006 to 2010, only one of 230 motorcycle fatalities involved an operator or passenger on a three-wheeler. From 2004 to 2008, motorcycles suffered an average of 628 injuries per year, and of those, an average of only 21, or 3.3%, were sustained by operators or passenger of three-wheel vehicles. Most notably, of the almost 241,000 motorcycle endorsements held by riders in 2010, only 220 are restricted to three-wheelers. In summary, we do support Senate Bill 133 to exempt operators of three-wheelers from the mandatory rider training requirement. They're not shown to be a significant safety problem based upon motorcycle fatality and injury data. The population is very small, and adapting existing curriculum or creating new curriculum to accommodate this population is not an efficient use of motorcycle safety funds.
Could either of you contrast now the you have to have a motorcycle endorsement to do a three-wheeler?
And it's probably a better question for the Department of Motor Vehicles, but yes, you can get a Type J license to ride a three-wheeler. If you have an M endorsement for motorcycle on your license, you can ride either a two-wheel or a three-wheel motorcycle. But if you only wish to ride a three-wheel, you get a special J endorsement, I believe it's called, and you are limited then to a three-wheel motorcycle.
So some of the new cars that are being built are three-wheeled. The Akimoto and Eugene, would they be required to get a motorcycle endorsement? And it's actually a fully enclosed car, but it's three-wheeled, and I know it's classified by the FedDOT as a motorcycle.
Again, that might be better addressed by the DMV, but it's my understanding that that is the case, that they would be required to get a Type J. But
if it's an enclosed cab, it's my understanding that it's exempt.
If it's an enclosed cab.
Okay. Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Burdick.
This is the first I've heard of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety, and I'm just wondering what your position is, or if you have one, on motorcycle helmets.
I know that the committee has taken a position that we stand with the existing law. Senator Burdick, Senator Beyer, that's not why I was here today. I can voice my personal opinion that I'm in healthcare, long-term care management, and have had over the last 30 years a lot of opportunity to deal with head injuries. I would no more climb on a motorcycle without a helmet. I just wouldn't do it. I stand with it. I think it saves the taxpayer money. And I realize this is a sidebar to our discussion here today, but I know how much that care costs. I know how quickly insurance can run out in the care. And at that point in time, we are not a society that says you are out of insurance, you are out of money, we're going to pull the plug. At that point in time, the injured people go on Medicaid and become a burden to all of us as taxpayers. I think it's our obligation, our fiduciary of this body, to protect the taxpayer and use funds wisely.
And Mr. Garretts, your organization, do you have a position on motorcycle helmets?
We recommend that riders wear all the gear, which includes helmet, eye protection, long sleeve, jacket, pants, all the gear all the time.
Okay. But the law, you both the organizations...
The organization has taken a no stance on the mandatory helmet law. We recommend all the gear all the time.
We have taken a stance, the Governor's Advisory Committee has, on an official vote, and we stand with the law and against the current proposal to change it.
Okay. The reason I ask, Mr. Chair, is when someone's trying to make an argument for safety, this issue goes to the credibility, in my opinion.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions for these two gentlemen? Thank you both. Sir. Mr. John.
Yes. Senator Beyer. Members of the committee.
I represent the Oregon Confederation of Motorcycle Clubs, and we don't have a problem. We see that there's only 30 people that this affects. What we would like to see is the definition of a motorcycle changed. Because a motorcycle is 801.365 Oregon Revised Statute 3 is designed to travel with more than three wheels in contact with the ground. Well, right now we're creating a whole class of vehicles with three-wheelers. And if one of them happens to get in a wreck, like Mr. Garrett said, they fall under the motorcycle statistics. However, they will not fall under the little guideline in the statistics. Was this person trained? And it's unreasonable to ask for training for 30 people. What we're asking is for that revised statute to move from three wheels on the ground to two.
I understand. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Does anybody else wish to comment? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 133, and I believe that...
Can we open a work session to discuss the amendments? Or no. That's the 1.5% reduction. Okay. We need to carry over.
We'll carry over. Okay, so members, we are not going to work today. As I mentioned, Senate Bills 438, 506, 586, 442, and we passed the others. So we will be carrying over those four, as well as Senate Bills 795, 672, 775, and 133. Any further business in front of the committee? Seeing none, we're adjourned.